Hello, and welcome to The Signal. I'm Kaylee Stevens.
And I'm Molly McNaughton. We're journalism students in the audio workshop at the University of King's College.
Today on the show,
making your bus ride just a little bit easier. Ticket scanners are coming to Halifax Transit.
I think it'll just give people more options.
Kaylee will have that story later.
Also coming up, chainsaws and flying ice.
All the little intricate little marks they make and how detailed they get is just amazing.
Hannah Vino takes us to the Downtown Dartmouth Ice Festival. And
if you are experiencing challenges with your mental or emotional health, you should have access.
Eunice Abaga visits a local nonprofit clinic. She brings us the story today. But first, after 4 years of waiting, the HFX Go Transit app became available to Haligonians in November 2023. Now, Halifax Transit is installing the second half of the project into buses across the municipality. Kaylee, this is your story.
It is! Have a listen! For 3 months, Haligonians have been discovering the ins and outs of the new HFX Go Transit app, purchasing tickets on their phones, and flashing their QR codes to drivers as they get onto buses. Now Halifax Transit is installing ticket scanners on all buses in the HRM. Instead of showing their ticket to the bus driver, riders will be able to quickly scan the app as they get on. Mark Santilli is Halifax Transit's Manager of Technical Services. He says this is a smart next step for the project.
It's just a more secure system to have the scanner in place. Visual validation means that we are susceptible to certain types of fraud. The scanner will prevent that sort of thing from happening.
Jake Sullivan is a regular HFX Go user. He says he's looking forward to the addition of the scanners.
You just have to scan your QR code, and if already late at night, you need a bus ticket, you can just buy it on your phone.
Once operating, there are plans for these scanners to have credit and debit tapping capabilities. Santilli says the goal is to make using Halifax Transit as accessible as possible.
I think it'll just give people more options. I know that in recent years there has been a good segment of the public that's been complaining about finding exact change is difficult, and the number of retailers that sell monthly passes and tickets is limited. And so we're hoping to alleviate some of those concerns by giving people other options and hopefully more convenient options.
As buses are still operating, the installation of the scanners has been challenging. But Santilli says that scanners should be up and running by the end of March or early April. For The Signal, I'm Kaylee Stevens in Halifax.
I ride the bus often, and I think a tap option would be great for me.
Me too. I think that's what I'm looking forward to the most.
You know what else I'm looking forward to, Kaylee?
What?
This next story, because this ice is no joke.
Hundreds of people crowded into the streets of downtown Dartmouth this weekend for the 5th annual Ice Festival. About 20 artists participated to create more than 60 ice sculptures. Hannah Vino has the story.
The roar of chainsaws and the sound of chipping ice fills the air on Portland Street. Liam Tromans is a first-time ice carver at the event. He has been a pro chainsaw carver for 10 years. After seeing other people working with ice, he decided to give it a try.
I love it. It carves like air. But wood is just harder to carve, and it's more sanding, more finish, varnish stains, burning, whatever. Ice, you carve it, leave it, walk away, and you're done. You know, you don't have to worry about it. It's going to melt anyway, so just no care or maintenance.
Many people stopped to watch Troman's carve. He completed 6 sculptures. They range from the blue nose and a lighthouse to a salmon. He said that the feedback about his sculptures was very positive.
Yeah, that's a great comment. People were really friendly, really, and the kids love it, right? So, yeah. And they try to guess what you're doing when you first start, so it's pretty fun.
The sculptures made for a great photo opportunity. Amber McCullough was among the many who attended.
It's wonderful and beautiful, and it's wonderful weather for the ice sculpting, and watching them do it is just amazing. All the little intricate little marks they make and how detailed they get is just amazing.
She said that she will definitely be back next year, something Tromans hopes to do as well.
Yeah, I'll do more now. I got the bug now, so yeah, I got the ice carving bug now, so I'll keep going with it.
For The Signal, I'm Hannah Vino in Dartmouth.
By the way, Molly, Liam Tromans told Hannah that if he gets invited next year, he might carve a lobster to keep the maritime theme going.
Cool. I'll be sure to check it out next year.
Many Nova Scotians have trouble accessing mental health care. That is especially true for marginalized people. A nonprofit clinic in Halifax is trying to change that. The founders of People's Counseling Clinic are advocating for more community-based mental health care. Eunice Abaga spoke to them, and she is here now. Hi, Eunice.
Hi, Kelly. Thanks for having me.
You visited the People's Counseling Clinic. Tell us about it.
Yes, indeed. I met with Robert Wright and James Dubé, the clinic's founders. They offer counseling services to people who might not otherwise get them. They work with both the victims and perpetrators of abuse, with people of all genders. They work with people who have many social and mental health problems. They're not focused on treating only one condition or one social problem. Here is James Dubé and the clinic manager.
We're really advocating for services that help everyone, as well, and fill in gaps in services and advocate for changes that meet different people and people with diverse needs. So,
those people can go to this clinic for treatment for free. Robert Wright is the executive director. He says the clinic has qualified people with the right backgrounds to help them.
We draw clinicians from with backgrounds and with training that makes them committed to serving these multi-problemed street-affected clients that we're expert in serving.
Eunice, why is there such a need for a clinic like this?
It's because the people they are serving have a lot of issues to deal with, so they need a lot of extra time and attention. And that is something primary healthcare practitioners cannot always offer.
One-size-fits-all programming just doesn't work, so they don't come to us with one issue. And, you know, because of the various problems that are happening in their lives, they often miss appointments. They need different kinds of counseling and things like that. And we've become a clinic that's very flexible and very accommodating in that respect. So.
That was James Dubé of the People's Counseling Clinic. And Kaylee, they don't only offer counseling.
How else do they support these clients?
They often provide supporting documents for court cases, for example. Sometimes, they can help our clients start to recognize that they are going through trauma. And Robert says they help in other practical ways, too.
Because all of these things are the structural problems that are affecting their mental health. And that we can't simply deal with the symptoms that they're dealing with. We actually have to deal with the causes.
Earlier, we said they hope to see more community-based practices like theirs. What can you tell us about that?
Robert Wright told me that to be successful in creating the conditions for improved mental health for all Nova Scotians, we have to rethink our health goals and the way we deliver services. And that includes more community-based practices and alternative funding. Marge Murray is the co-executive director of the Canadian Mental Health Association in Halifax Dartmouth branch. She also wants to see a change.
If there was adequate investment in community organizations, more work could be done to really help people and more accessible and, you know, real core funding.
What's next for the People's Counseling Clinic?
Robert Wright said that in conversation with the Provincial Department of Health and Wellness, there's a real commitment to use that as an opportunity to advance their work for the health and well-being of Nova Scotians.
I can really see how important this is for the community. Thanks for being here to share this with us, Eunice.
Thank you for having me.
That was The Signal's Eunice Abaga.
You're listening to The Signal on CKDU, 88.1 FM in Halifax. You can also find us on Spotify and SoundCloud. Just search The Signal, a Halifax podcast. We're bringing you stories from the audio workshop at the University of King's College. I'm Kaylee Stevens.
And I'm Molly McNaughton. Still to come on the show.
Here we go again. The Halifax Queer Ensemble is hoping to scale up as they look for new members and challenge stereotypes. Kate Berrio will tune us in later.
And welcome to the dark side.
I love a good Nova Scotia road trip. I will drive 4 hours one way to go to a grave and then drive home the 4 hours back.
Molly meets a local TikToker who shares Nova Scotian history by visiting graveyards.
New students who arrive, they usually don't come with thick winter coats, or if they do, it's not quite warm enough for Canadian winter.
Don't let your clothes hang around. Dalhousie's International Center is looking for winter clothing donations. Victoria Brzezinski-Shadjanis will have more.
I mean, everybody gets sad, and being sad makes the best music.
Coming up, the bands making peer emo will introduce you to your new favorite music to cry to. Dylan Taylor shares the tissues and tunes later.
After several year hiatus, the Halifax Queer Ensemble is back. The ensemble is looking for new members for the 2024 season. Kate Berrio gives us a peek behind the curtain.
The Halifax Queer Ensemble has been running since 2018. It is a wind band with everything from clarinets to trombones. After a few years away due to the pandemic, they are looking to come back for an encore. Jessica Amador is the co-director of the ensemble.
It's really nice to be able to bring together a group of people from like diverse backgrounds, you know, musicians, non-musicians, people who were musicians in the past life. And yeah, it's been really amazing to get to see these people and meet these people and make music with them. It's just been, yeah, it's been a really wonderful experience.
Amador has a background in studying French horn, choral singing, and conducting. She joined in 2019 when the group had about 30 members. They are now down to 8. She hopes to see that change.
I'm just really hopeful that this can grow to become a good space for queer musicians in particular to gather and meet and hang out and experience things together. I think that as far as especially the band community and like classical music communities, it isn't necessarily very inclusive. I think that in general, if you're auditioning to an orchestra or like a wind band or something like that, it's a very formalized process. It's a very intense kind of thing. There's those barriers.
Amador's co-director, Jacob Keynes, had this in mind while creating the ensemble. He wanted to create a space that's warm and welcoming, something different than what the community already offers.
There are so many queer spaces that are party-based and drinking-based and not social-based, and this was a really big part of forming the queer ensemble, was having a space that was open to all age groups, all people who identify as queer, who want to come and just make friends and make music.
Abby Frias plays trumpet in the ensemble. She likes it because it's comforting for someone like her, who is studying away from home.
It's really nice to be playing with other musicians who are like a little bit scared and just like still trying to like dip their toes back into it. And on top of that, it's nice to have like another queer community. I just moved out here from Ontario, so having this community on Tuesday nights is really nice.
Keynes also runs a podcast called Classical Queer, where he talks about musicians from around the world, and a database where people can discover queer Canadian musicians. He did it to help people who don't see themselves represented in classical music.
It's a really different thing to identify as a queer musician than a traditional classical musician, and I probably identify as both. I mean, I teach classical music at a university, but it's a different thing to identify as a queer classical musician.
The Halifax Queer Ensemble is open to all ages. You don't need prior experience to join. there is something you do need.
We can only provide certain instruments. So as long as you have an instrument and you can kind of read music and you want to come play with some queer people, you are more than welcome to come join.
For The Signal, I'm Kate Barrio in Halifax.
If you're interested in joining, reach out to their Instagram at Halifax Queer Ensemble.
A local TikToker has gained a massive following, telling stories about local people who would otherwise be forgotten. Molly went to a graveyard for this story.
My name is Ashley Drake, and I'm from Halifax, Nova Scotia, and I have a TikTok account here of dark history in Nova Scotia.
It's a cloudy day at Christ Church Cemetery in Dartmouth. Cars drive by, but that's about it. There's nobody around except Ashley Drake, dressed head to toe in black. She's taking videos of a headstone for her next TikTok.
I started the TikTok account when I discovered the Titanic grave sites here in Halifax. That was one of the sites that I had not seen after living here for like 15 years. So I wanted to go see them, and I figured the Titanic's such a big thing, I wanted to share it with the world, and I didn't think that it was going to take off so much. And then I just kind of went from story to story, and here we are. The 227th body recovered after the sinking of the Titanic was that of Jay Dawson. For decades, his grave was just another name until the 1997 blockbuster Titanic turned it into a shrine.
The video you're hearing is one of Ashley's TikToks. It reached more than 3 million views and more than 400,000 likes. First, she records the gravestone. Then she goes home to edit her videos, overlaying it with pictures of newspaper obituaries or headshots. Melancholy music plays in the background while she narrates the tragic personal lives of everyday people.
I don't like to focus on stories that are current. I don't want anyone to ever be scrolling through their For You page and seeing a story of, you know, about their cousin or their relative and get upset by that. So I try to focus on stories that are around 100 years old. I'm not really affecting anybody personally with those stories. And it's also a way to bring their story back into light. There's a chance that someone might have not talked about them for 100 years.
She finds her stories by researching online newspaper archives.
I really love researching. I find it's like a very healthy habit. It helps with, you know, reducing anxiety, even though I'm like talking about things that are not very happy.
Ashley is a dark arts imagery photographer by profession. That's how she first ended up in the graveyard.
I kind of always loved dark and spooky things. I started out doing photography in that manner, and it took me to a lot of graveyards, and then I kind of started focusing on the graves and the stories of the people who are in them.
Ashley's latest story is about Patricia Hetherington.
In January of 1922, a 9-year-old girl from Nova Scotia was accidentally killed when she was hit by a truck while coasting on the Dartmouth streets. Patricia Hetherington's sled collided with the truck around 5 p.m. in the immediate neighborhood of her father's home.
What stood out to you in particular about this story?
I think maybe I have a daughter that's the same age as Patricia, and sledding, coasting as they called it back then, is just such a childhood activity that you would want to do. It's been just over 100 years, so I thought she is probably owed a visit.
From reading Goosebumps to watching true crime as a child, Ashley has always been fascinated by horror, graveyards, and dark history.
Dark history, to me, is anything that happened in our past that has a dark side to it. So it's not really a happy story of something that happened. It's a darker, you know, a sad, a morbid side of history that we don't often talk about.
Dusty Kelleher talks about it all the time. He runs the Halifax Ghost Walk and understands why people are so fascinated by folklore and scary stories.
People like to be scared. I think it's horror movies and jump scares and things that might be a little bit creepy or unsettling. All of that kind of just gets the blood running.
And for Ashley Drake, it's more than just the excitement of being frightened. She also wants to pay her respects.
I also like to go and visit their grave, just let them know that people are still remembering their stories and what happened to them.
Although there doesn't seem to be a big dark history scene in Halifax, according to Ashley, you might just find it on social media. Ashley has more than 185,000 followers on TikTok. That's where she found her community of dark history lovers.
I do have a lot of friends that I've made on TikTok that do the same kind of videos for me, or as me, I should say. There's a couple in the States that I'm really close with, and then a girl from Ontario. So different provinces, but I haven't, and states, but I haven't had anybody here.
For The Signal, I'm Molly McNaughton in Dartmouth. If you want to check out some of Ashley's stories, you can find her on TikTok at Halloween Photograph Fiend. That's Photograph Fiend, PHOTOGRAFIEND. Monday's snowstorm brought strong winds and more than 15 centimeters of snow. In weather like this, you need more than one layer to stay warm outside. But what if you don't have the right clothes for cold weather? For some international students, buying winter clothing is just not an option. Dalhousie's International Center is trying to help. Victoria Brzezinski-Shadjanis is here to tell us how. Hi, Victoria.
Thanks for having me.
How is the International Center trying to help?
They started a winter clothing donations program in mid-January. Students and staff can bring their donations to the International Center. Students in need of winter clothes can then pick up the donations. I spoke with Erica Somerville, who is running the program this year.
I'm hoping that once I have a little bit of stock built up, that it can be like a take a penny, leave a penny situation where it could be self-run. So students will come, drop things off, put it on the hangers, leave it on the table, and people can come pick it up.
Erica's office is on Lamartine Street. In front of the office sits a small white table and a clothing rack. But when I went to see her, there was only a couple of hats and scarves on the little table. Maybe two coats were hanging on the rack.
So there's not much there so far. How big is the need?
Erica told me some students simply cannot afford new clothes. And some students who come to Halifax from warmer countries are not always prepared for a Canadian winter.
Especially for the students who arrived in January, a lot of the students came from South Asia. So I'd imagine that they are quite surprised with the minus 13 wind chill temperature.
So they are asking for mostly coats, boots, gloves, the typical winter clothing. Erica is donating a few of her clothes as well, sweaters, socks, and maybe scarves.
How long has this program been running?
There was a similar program last year. Marva Williams was running it.
What we did, we just did an ad. And we just pretty much asked if anyone had any winter clothing that they wanted to bring in, or if any student were in need of winter gears, then they could come and pick up. And then we collected everything, we kept it. And then on a specific day, we had like a little gathering. People could come in, get some winter clothes, do some swaps.
That was Marva Williams, the administrative assistant at the International Center. Marva told me they did not get a lot of donations last year either.
What has the turnout been like for the current program?
Slow, apparently. So far, they received only 3 sets of donations, including Erica's. When I spoke with students, they were not really aware of the program, even though some think this is a good idea.
I think that's a really good opportunity to get together the students, international students, to help to a great cause to students who cannot afford winter clothes, because with the inflation in Canada as well, it can be quite difficult to afford those kind of things. So I think that's a really good thing that the International Center has organized.
The International Center is spreading the word on social media. They're also hoping to organize a clothing swap to bring attention to the program.
Thanks, Victoria. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
That was The Signal's Victoria Brzezinski-Shadjanis. The winter clothing recycling program is on until the end of the semester. Graduating students can also donate their clothes at the end of winter. Their donations will be used next year.
Halifax bands have been putting a maritime twist on emo music. They call it pier emo. That's pier as in the thing where boats dock. Dylan Taylor met these bands to learn more about a genre that hurts your ears and breaks your heart.
What is emo music? It's a trickier question to answer than you might think.
The emo bands in Halifax seem to agree on where it came from.
Comes from DC hardcore in the 80s.
Came out of the DC hardcore scene.
DC emotional hardcore scene in the 80s, I would say.
But what exactly makes an emo song, that's a little more controversial. Phoenix Faust is the leader of popular emo band Captain Sunshine. She says emo is all about feelings.
The main focus is on, like, emotions. Like, not good emotions.
In other words, emo is the music that makes people slather on thick eyeliner and crank up the distortion on their guitars. Captain Sunshine is at the forefront of Halifax's very own emo movement. The first proper peer emo show took place a couple Saturdays ago at Radstorm. That's an all-ages alternative venue on Gottingen Street, and it was completely packed. The bill, which included Captain Sunshine, spotlighted emo bands from Halifax. The show sold out. Phoenix and her bandmate, Tal Kubi Bahal, say it was a big first for their band.
I was really surprised when the person at the door was turning people away, and I was like, wow, just like a couple of local bands can do that.
The numbers are especially impressive given the band's age.
I'm 15.
I'm 16, but I'll be 17 in like 2 weeks.
Many of the peer emo bands are in a similar age bracket.
To maybe say something kind of corny, it's like made for kids by kids.
Ryan Napier plays bass in the band Breakfast Time. They were on this Radstorm bill as well. Napier's in his mid-20s, which makes him a self-admitted geezer by peer emo standards.
It's being driven and like all the initiative is happening by like really young people in it who are, I think, achieving a massive amount for their age. That I remember being their age and just wanting desperately to do that and not knowing how to, or maybe just not having the gumption to make it happen.
Many kinds of emo are tied to specific places. Midwest emo is the most famous example. This kind of music comes from, you guessed it, the Midwest. Peer emo is similar.
It's like a Midwest emo, but yeah, for like Atlanta, Canada, or maybe it's Halifax, or maybe it's Nova Scotia, or whatever. There's not really like a defined border.
That's Cal Belisle. They release music under the name Angry Wild Elephant. They were the first to describe their music as peer emo, and I asked them how an emo scene develops over a game of Super Smash Bros.
I mean, the Midwest emo exists because the Midwest is
probably one of the most depressing places on the planet.
Exactly. Is Atlanta, Canada a sad place to live?
Yeah. I would say there's definitely elements of that. Like we're kind of like historically we're a have not province.
Ryan from Breakfast Time has a more meteorological explanation.
I mean, if there's one thing I could think of, it's probably the fact that like we do get kind of murky weather here, and maybe that's inspiring some sad songs.
It might not be possible to blame all the melancholy on Nova Scotia. Jessie Everill played the Radstorm show with her band I Dialed Your Number. She says the people are behind it all.
I don't think this is a sad place to live. Personally, I love living here. I think we just have sad lives, and so we kind of reflect that through our music. I mean, everybody gets sad, and being sad makes the best music.
The peer emo crew are only looking to grow. In fact, they'd like you to come to the next show.
When you kind of tunnel in on where you live and your community and meet people who are doing this kind of thing locally, it's really amazing because like they're people and they live where you live and could be you.
For The Signal, I'm Dylan Taylor.
The music you heard in that story was from I Dialed Your Number. The track is called Bunny Goes to Business School. You can find it along with the rest of her album, Hourglass, anywhere music is streamed. That's our show for today. Thanks to our social media editor this week, Eunice Abaga. Molly, where can they find us on social media? You can find us on TikTok, Instagram, and X at SignalHFX. On Facebook, we're The Signal Halifax. Thanks to our producer, Hannah Vino, and associate producer, Victoria Brzezinski-Shadanis. A shout out to our technician, Mark Pignot, in the control room. Woo-hoo! Our audio professor is Christina Harnett. I'm Kaylee Stevens.
And I'm Molly McNaughton. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week with more stories for you.